the world needs to calm the fuck down a bit, I think. Sorry.
Hi, this is Guy English.
And this is Renee Ritchie, and welcome to Debug. Today we are revisiting Don Melton, because the minute after we let him go last time, Google announced Blink, Samsung, and Mozilla announced Servo, and the entire world went topsy-turvy. Is that fair, Don?
Yeah, to talk about Blink first, and by the way, you know, I don't normally comment on Apple's current efforts, policies, and things like that. But since WebKit is an open source project, I'll keep my my comments narrow to that. I was surprised it was that particular day from the announcement, but this was not unexpected. You know, something like Blink. Well, the name was unexpected. Blink, who the hell came up with that? But I've really been expecting them to fork for a while. I figured they would fork after we announced WebKit 2. So, you know, it's not unexpected. And they're allowed to fork. I mean, WebKit is open source. Essentially, I did the same with KHTML and KJS almost 12 years ago. So it's not that big a deal. And, you know, it doesn't mean everybody needs to chill the fuck out, to use the F-bomb again. It doesn't mean the death of WebKit or the ascendancy of Blink or anything else like that. You know, some things just got easier and some things got harder for both projects and both teams. And I got real annoyed at the press because, you know, Blink isn't suddenly more streamlined since it's left the quote-unquote crufty old WebKit. I can guarantee you code is being jettisoned from WebKit 2, maybe even more so than from Blink, but who knows? So it's not that big a deal.
Do you think that like the stated goal, I guess, was to jettison a bunch of platform support that they don't need and try to sort of clean things up a little bit?
I think that's the stated goal. But in a way, I think it's really about control.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, all forks are about control. Mm-hmm. Doing a big cooperative project like that, there's always, body checking. Mm-hmm. But especially when you have big companies and big personalities, but it's not really that big a deal. I mean, the thing is, when you're in the web browser or web content engine business, you kind of know everybody after a while. I mean, I've worked on, well, depending on how you count, three of these systems, and I know a lot of people, and you know, there's nobody that I don't want to talk to. I mean, I still talk from folks from time to time. You know, I still talk to Brendan Eich on occasion, Mike Shaver, even though he's over at Facebook now. And I talked to Dean Hachimovich at Microsoft every once in a while. Hell, he's a Facebook friend, you know, so... It's, you know, these things are complicated, and I don't want to project something onto a situation that was not there. I don't think anybody is particularly panicked or all that upset on either side. And you have to remember that the projects are still more alike than they're different now, and they probably will be for a while.
Was it a reasonable fear that, you know, people would wake up and it would be IE6 all over again and you'd have to add special exemptions for Blink and different code for Chrome and the web would go back to having isolated islands? I think that was the panicked response when the announcement came out.
Well, there's been a panic for a while about the whole WebKit monoculture thing, and maybe the only good thing that comes out of this in the short term is it calms those people now because you've got two of these things now. I think that was some concern, but let's see what happens. I mean, it's too early. Anybody that claims to know what's going to happen here is full of shit, including me.
Right.
So, and the other thing to keep in mind is that this, like I said, the press that I read about this was really annoying me because, you know, it's great for Google, it's bad for Apple kind of thing, and that's kind of horseshit. Yeah, I mean, it cuts both ways. You know, Google is not going to have the crew that started WebKit. You know, they don't have Maciej Stachowiak, David Hyatt, or Darren Adler that is still working on WebKit, right? And, you know, they don't have Adele Peterson, Sam Wenig, or Jeff Guerin. You know, those are kinds of things that they miss too. And they, you know, they don't have the other resources. You know, Apple's not going to have obviously some of their people and some of the other things, but it's not death.
Yeah, so
it's
okay. You feel it got spun into being a massive corporate.
It's not really that big a deal.
Battle. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's big corporations, and I think when you work on WebKit, you try to like ignore that as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you talk to some of the WebKit and Blink people, probably dealing with W3C and other organizations, more of a hassle than that. That's always been a headache over the years.
So you're basically telling the kids that, you know, mommy and daddy won't live together anymore, but everything's still going to be okay.
Well, the thing is, they're still going to have to live together. I mean, if you think that if Apple does a security patch in a piece of code that used to be shared, you know, fixes some bug, you don't think Google is not going to go over and figure out what the diff is patch and put that in. You know, they're going to have to do that kind of work, and they're going to have to work together and talk to each other still for that kind of thing. And it goes both ways. If Google, you know, comes up with something in a piece of shared code they used to have, and Apple thinks that would be useful, the Apple guys. And it's not just the Apple guys. There are lots of other people besides Apple working on WebKit, and there are other people besides Google working on Blink. And, you know, maybe this is something that doesn't completely last. There have been times when projects have forked and they've come back together. Who knows?
Right.
One of the more interesting announcements was Servo. I wasn't quite expecting that.
And apparently, from the rumors at least, that was deliberately done right in front of Blink just to get out ahead of them. Which is interesting.
I suppose Mozilla would have done that. to get everybody distracted. I mean, they needed some press there. So it's a...
what do we know about Servo? Because it's a whole
nothing.
New thing, right? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's they're wanting to go out and rewrite their engine and use the new language that they've been working on for several years called Rust. To rewrite the engine. And they're not rewriting everything in Rust. They're rewriting the core. You know, they're essentially rewriting large parts of Gecko in Rust, but I don't think they're rewriting everything. I think it would probably be crazy to rewrite everything, but I'm not sure. One of the reasons they said they needed to use Rust was for performance, and I'm not quite buying that, because C++ seems to have been working fine for WebKit and the LLVM teams for years. So I'm not buying that. But
The other one was this, they said security too, right? But
yeah, and I don't know why the language really. I mean, you can write secure code in COBOL.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think it has affordances that makes it easier to, like, you know, avoid buffer overruns and that kind of the basic stuff.
That kind of stuff, yeah. But we investigated things like that at Apple. You have to be very careful with that, because you can also introduce tremendous performance penalties.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to do it in a generalized way in places where you don't actually need it, you want to focus on where the real problems are. So you have to be careful with that. And so rewriting an engine from scratch is not always wise. I mean, when we started Safari and WebKit, I didn't want to rewrite the engine from Scratch. I knew they would fire me before I was able to get something done. That's why I use something off the shelf.
Right.
And we eventually rewrote it. The WebKit, you know, people don't realize is that WebKit has been rewritten multiple times. It's always rewritten, refactored, and redone. It's a subtle little thing that the WebKit team has always been doing. That's why it's so up to date and cool, because it's always being re-engineered. But yeah, it's done in small chunks, carefully.
Right.
I mean,
it does seem a little foolhardy to kind of just publicly say that you're going to rewrite an engine with a new language, and it's biting off a lot to chew.
Props to them for having the stones to do it. I mean, you know, if they can pull it off.
I think the Samsung angle is really interesting here too, because you know they do Android, but they used to do Bada. Now they're doing Tizen on the side, and they have the Android browser and the Chrome browser, but now they're doing Servo on the side.
Samsung, I cannot figure out. I mean, it seems to me that there's somebody with a magic eight ball over there, just rotating it and trying to figure out technology choices. At least for software, I can't. Can't figure out what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, I don't understand them at all. They're making money, so.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't understand what their thinking is.
In the mobile space, it's basically the two people making money on hardware are Apple, who makes the most, and then Samsung. And nobody else makes really any money these days to speak of. So, hey.
So did Gecko need a. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Maybe they'll pull this off. Who knows? Best of luck to them. I mean, I know some of the people over there working on that. They're good. They're good people. They're smart people. Yeah. I mean,
well, it's certainly an interesting direction to go in. You know, rather than just grabbing off the shelf stuff, like trying to actually, you know, roll your own is kind of it's an interesting play for them.
Yeah. And, being kind of a web engine geek, I'm sure I'll download it and try to compile it and stuff like that, like I do occasionally when the fit hits me for other things, and see what's happening. I mean, you know, running WebKit nightlies and stuff. I've done that for years, and you know, to keep apprised of what's going on and to nag people I know about, you know, some bug or something else that I've hit. And I do that for lots of other projects, you know, just hobbies. But you know, it goes back to having the superpowers, right? That's as a geek, you can do that kind of stuff. Yeah. I do not recommend this for other people.
No, the nightlies aren't for everybody.
No, WebKit nightlies are very, very stable. But I don't recommend them for everybody. I think a lot of people who run them are actually not the developers. The code developers there are website developers, content developers who run the nightlies. And I think that's actually a really good thing, because that's especially who you want feedback from, content developers.
Yeah, like a broad testing.
You need to listen to those people.
Yeah. Is that true for what's it called? Servo. Is Servo public at all yet? Or is it just a name?
I haven't looked yet. I'm waiting until I see something on Hacker News and I'm like, oh, okay, I'll go in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Seems like
that's what everybody does, right? So anyway, the short thing is everybody calm down about WebKit and Blink and the teams do their jobs, and Servo, interesting, and best of luck with that. Yeah, they're all still going to work. I mean, there's not a...
I don't think we're going to get back to the time where like the web is so bifurcated between different, like totally different engines. I don't think it's in anybody's best interest.
It's not the engines we should be worrying about with the web. It's co-opting the web in other ways is what we should be worrying about.
Okay.
You know, if governments take over essential services and technologies, that's when you're worried, because governments are always know what they're doing. Yeah. So that's the kind of crap I worry about. But this, these little pissing contests between engines and other stuff like that, or supposed pissing contests, because there's not really that kind of thing going on. I mean, I know several people in the Blink team. I mean, some of those guys I hired, you know, either at Netscape, at least one at Apple, one over there. So it's these are nice people. You know, they're
I don't think this needs to be a consumer level conflict necessarily. It's just it's just the way the code is going, and it makes sense to sort of split it down the middle and go in different directions.
Yeah, we'll see what they come up with, and whatever.
Next. Was the what next?
Next.
I love that it's like the big news and you're just bored by it. Like, no.
Well, you know, it was, as you said, it was like several weeks ago. And my attention span is very short anyway. So,
yeah. And it should be, because I don't think this is a bit, certainly not now.
No.
I don't think this is big news.
The thing to do is that, you know, a year from now, have a retrospective and say, we still don't know. Yeah, remember the Blink.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and even a year from now, I can't see anything huge. I mean, like what?
I think projects are still going to be very similar. So it's not going to be that deal.
Yeah. It seems like a huge code base, and it would take a long time to go in a radically different direction. Not only that, the goal is to render everything the same anyway. So from a user's perspective, I don't see this being such a big deal, you know?
Yeah, from a user's perspective, it could be better. It could be an improvement, because competition. Look at what happened when we came out with WebKit and Safari. Mm-hmm. And I talked about this during my talk at Ool, how we made Safari fast. I mean, we started the second browser war. It was a performance war. And that was just better for everybody.
Yeah, because I mean, when you're building this, you're making decisions, right? You're like, this is the way we're going to go, and any one of those decisions might have gone either way, and you couldn't, you know, with WebKit and Blink, you get like a bit of an A/B test. You can try a different approaches,
right? And there's competition among teams. There certainly always has been. Remember the acid tests, those silly acid tests that even Hixie says that they're silly. you know, there's competitions between all the different browser teams to, you know, try to get the best scores on that. And some of that was just, you know, kind of nonsensical. But in other ways, it improved everybody's engine.
Right.
It's a shame that, you know, there's not going to be an Opera engine anymore. But.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that fallout. Poor Opera, man. So what happened there? They decided to go with Blink?
ICE and then Blink, yeah.
Well, they decided to go with Chromium, right? People were saying that they were choosing WebKit. They're really choosing it as Chromium, because they needed a GUI, because they were not only letting go of members of the core team, they're letting go, you know, members of the UI team and stuff like that. So they needed a project that was a browser too. So they'll naturally follow the Blink path rather than the straight WebKit path, because they need GUI. I mean, Apple does not open source Safari.
Right. Yeah. They were, that's kind of a shame, because I know they had the weird spotty support at times, but I kind of like having the sort of bio.
Oh yeah, I've ran. Yeah. Well, you know, like I'm a browser geek, so I have every browser ever made, and I usually have. Let me go into Launchpad here, and on my top row on Launchpad, you know, I've got Safari, Firefox, Chrome, and Opera right up there, and then I got VMware, so I can run not VMware, VirtualBox, so I can run multiple versions of Internet Explorer. So, and so I got a simulator renter somewhere so I can run, you know, the older versions of stuff just when I get nostalgic.
So you have some browser cred, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, well, you know, that's like being a browser fanboy. That doesn't mean cred, yeah. Right? So, but a lot of content developers have that same thing. But I've had to have that for years for testing purposes and stuff, right?
So you mentioned briefly, but you were in Dublin for the Yule conference recently. And yes. You gave a talk about making Safari fast.
Actually, it's pronounced Yule, not Yule. 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 Okay. And I got dope slapped for that a couple of times. Cool conference, and it was the best conference ever. Let me tell you, it was fantastic. And the hosts, Paul Campbell and Dermot Daly, are just wonderful people. And they put together this conference that's not only wonderful for all the speakers, but wonderful for all the attendees. And frankly, if I was a sponsor of the conference, I think it's wonderful for the sponsors too. It was it was fantastic to go to Dublin. I'd never been to Dublin, and to meet all those wonderful people and listen to just some amazing folks. I meet them, Matt Gamel on his silky smooth Scottish voice. I told I wish I could like bottle that voice and take it back to America. got to meet Gruber finally in person. He's hysterical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Along with my old friend Michael Lopp. And Horace Dedu and Michael Johnson, you know, Dr. Wave from Pixar. Yeah. I got to have dinner with them and Nevin Mergen and
Yeah, Nevin's great too.
Horace is a brilliant man. We were I think it was in one of the breaks in the afternoon, the sessions, we were all in this pub. I think it was one of the pub sessions sponsored by either Dropbox or GitHub. And we were standing there next to the bar interfering with other people's ability to get Guinness. Which I'll mention later. And, you know, Horace would say things, you know, would talk about the industry and say, you know, well, anyway, that's my theory. What do you think, Don? And I was getting to the point, I was joking with him, I was saying, damn it, Horace, you're right once again. at least in my opinion. He's a brilliant guy. And, of course, yeah. Michael Johnson, he's got so many stories from Pixar. And he and I had probably between the two of us some of the best Steve Jobs stories there, because we actually were two of the people.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we were both joking. We were two of the people who Steve actually knew our names, which was just a good thing and a bad thing. Other people there, Jamie Newberry from Black Pixel, she was great. Yep. Charles Perry, a guy I'd never heard of from this company called Leaf Hut Software. He did this talk on accessibility. Oh my God, it's the best talk on accessibility I've ever heard.
Yeah, I think that's an overlooked technology at times.
Yeah, it was.
More attention paid to that.
It was stunning. And of course, Jim Dalrymple was there. He talked about, I think on his podcast last week, about his quote-unquote panel discussion he had with Dave Wiskus and Kyle Neath, and which was not a panel discussion at all. It was a performance. They went out, set Dave and Kyle and one of the other people, I forget who it was, were introduced by, I think it was Dermot, sat on stools as if they were going to do a panel discussion, and they said, and here's Jim Dalrymple, and he walks out with a guitar. And so the panel was actually banned. Oh yeah, they did 12 cover tunes, all the original songs, of course, which are in my iTunes playlist. I don't know about your lesson kind of rock. Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, Nirvana, stuff like that was great stuff. And then an original composition by Jim that was fantastic.
Cool. But, so, yeah, it sounds like it was a blast.
Yeah, the people there were great. Got to meet the Lord Mayor of Dublin. He's hysterical.
Fancy.
And I had to practice pronouncing his name. Spelled N-A-O-I-S-E. And I guess it's pronounced Isha. I was like my new friend. Oshin Hurley. He was one of the sponsors, and his buddy Barry Scott from Converser. Oshin's name is spelled O-I-S-I-N. I mean, Gaelic. It's hard.
It's not even hard. A word. It's not a name. It's not even a word.
Yeah, it's a name. So, you know, what you learn to do is you have another Guinness. And let me tell you, if you go to Dublin, if you go to Ireland, you need to have a Guinness. Because when I went to Dublin and I drank my first Guinness, and not my only Guinness, let me tell you, it made every Guinness I've had in the States taste like piss.
I bet.
You know, they say it doesn't travel well, and they're right. And my wife who went with me, we went to the St. James Gate Brewery for the tour, mm-hmm. which was fantastic, and had one each poured for us up on the gravity bar up on the, I don't know, seventh or eighth story where you can overlook Dublin. Fantastic view. And it was like this marvelous beer milkshake. Oh my God.
So, that sounds great. I got to go. So I'll try to go next year.
Well,
I just hope Paul at McLaughlin is a super nice guy.
I want him to invite me back.
Don't worry. I'll put in a good word for you.
Yeah, Paul Dermott, I love you guys. No, seriously, they're really fantastic.
So you gave a talk about speeding up Safari. Do you want to give us gist of it?
Sure. It was a bit of history about how we made Safari fast. And one of my jokes in it, in the talk was, you know, we made it fast by making it slow first. Fortunately, too slow. And why I wanted to do the talk is I wanted to delve into a bit of history and inside baseball for people because they seem to enjoy that and things that they might not have heard that nobody had ever heard, as far as I know, outside of the fruit company, outside of my little sessions I would do at Apple in my department. You know, the new people in the department would sometimes say, "Gramps, tell us a story, something about back when you and Al Gore invented the internet." And I would.
So you'd sit around the campfire in the office and.
Yeah, pretty much, you know, around the couches and stuff like that. And I would tell stories, usually with Darren Adler hanging around too, because he's got even more stories than I do in a way, because he was back in Apple back in the late 80s and early 90s.
Mm.
So, he and I would have dueling bullshit going on sometimes. That was a lot of fun. But, and we, as you well know from talking to me, he and I both could talk for hours, so a lot of fun. Anyway, the new folks would actually listen and were semi-respectful, so hopefully they'll learn something from those talks, yeah. And I'm hoping they make a lot of stories of their own now. That's what they're doing.
No, I'm sure that's happening. That's, you know, it's the way things go, right?
Oh, yeah. That's.
So what was the gist? What was the takeaway from your talk?
The gist was that, what the hell? You know, I have my speech laying here. I'll just get up my notes. No, the gist of it was, you know, I asked at the end after I told the background story was, you know, what do you want to learn from this? And it's real simple principles that a lot of people know is, you know, you set the bar high on performance. You don't optimize ahead of time. You measure first. This is something people always do wrong. You focus on the bottlenecks. Then you just lather, rinse, repeat that. You make sure over time you add metrics. You never, ever regress. Ever. Never. Did I say never? You never, ever. And you make it
your
religion.
I think that's the big one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other one is you make it your religion.
Yeah.
You know, Dante's sixth, not the seventh circle of hell. It's good to be precise. Has a place for people who invent their own religion, and I'll probably be there right next to L. Ron Hubbard one day. And I told a thing at the conference. I said, you know, some teams out there like to have a performance month at the end of their projects. You know, they have an 18-month project and they have a performance month where they focus on performance before they ship. And we used to joke on the Safari team, we have performance month too, 12 times a year. So either make it your religion, you get serious about it, or you're not really focused on performance.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I worked on games, we, you know, obviously performance is an issue. And so often, like before some big milestone, there would just be like a giant push to try to get everything performing well. And it just felt like exactly the wrong thing to be doing. Like we should be more conscientiously keeping the frame rates up, you know, keeping the times down.
Yeah, you should be watching it all the time.
Throughout
that's
the entire
process. That's what we learned. That was the object lesson from, you know, the joke I made is how did we make Safari fast? Well, we made it really slow first. It was my fault. You know, we took our eye off the ball. I was so focused in the beginning of the project just to getting that bear to dance.
Right.
That, you know, I was unaware that it was shuffling across stage, not dancing.
Yeah. So. And one interesting thing about... Okay. One interesting thing about the web engines is that the content isn't under your control.
Interesting. It's not the word that I use for that. that's like the...
What's
Chinese
your word, Don?
Interesting times.
Exactly. Yeah. So what's your word? You can be as impolite as you like.
Yeah. Oh, God, that would take more than the...
It's difficult to make something performant when you don't control the input or you have no hope of controlling the input at all.
Right. Yeah. You have to realize that you have to approach a web engine the way you would approach a operating system. You know, it's almost as complex, very, very close. And people will do crazy ass things with your APIs. And you have to keep that in mind. That's why when I said, you know, WebKit nightlies, I'm always delighted when I hear content developers are out there using it. And I was like, yes, yes, please do that. Because if you notice something stupid in terms of capabilities or breakage or, more importantly, performance on your site, we always encouraged like a lot of the big JavaScript framework folks to please use the WebKit nightlies and tell us if you notice something going south right away. Because one, we'll fix it, and two, we'll figure out a way to turn that into a test, you know, another metric. Because a lot of these systems are so complex, they're very hard to test.
Was that something new that you like? When you were at Netscape, did you guys do like a bunch of tests all the time? Like, did you have a test suite, and did you do the time test suite, and like the sort of the similar stuff that you do in Safari?
It was not as rigorous back then as I'm sure the Mozilla team is doing now.
Right.
I mean, they're much more rigorous now because, you know, after WebKit debuted and Safari really shot up there in terms of performance compared to other browsers, and people were publishing stats on that. The Mozilla team, you know, had their come to Jesus moment, and they really got serious about performance too. And they adopted a lot of the same techniques, and they developed other things that you know, some of the, especially the conformance tests, the Mozilla conformance tests, they're open source, so everybody uses those. Some of the ones that we have you know, they use because they're open source. So they do that now. But back in the old days, we didn't really have criteria before shipment. We didn't have policies during development that, you know, prevented regressions. We were not as focused on that.
So how does that work at a... Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
So how does it work at sort of like a mechanical level? Like there's a check-in and then there's an automated test that runs, and if the timing is slower, then the check-in's just rejected or somebody gets an angry email or what?
Well, it's usually an angry email in the club. Yeah. In the beginning, what I was talking about in my talk, when we discovered the sloth and stuff, because we didn't have the automated tests on Safari in the beginning. We had a testing harness that Ken Kashindra wrote, God bless him, and that we were able to use. But it was very hard to get consistent results from it because, you know, testing the network. You're testing network I/O and other things. And believe it or not, I was one of the few people on the team who could actually run the damn test and get consistent results. It used to aggravate the engineers. But, you know, I'm just like being able to do that calls for this anal retentive psychosis, you know. That's just perfect for me. In another life, I was a QA engineer, I guess. And so I'd run the tests, and if I detected we were slower, I closed the tree. That was the beginning of my policy, the policy that I pulled out of my hiney, you know. And boy, talk about making yourself popular on your team doing that.
So let's say you'd literally lock down any other commit until until the speed was up. Yeah.
And they were like, the engineers at first was like, why are you locking everybody out? And I was like, prove to me that it was just one check-in that's the failure.
Mm.
Right? Unless we know what the problem is, nobody can add, I don't want anybody adding to the noise.
Right.
And I don't want to give up any gains. Why would you give up a gain? Right? Never regress. And the thing is, with a no regressions policy, and by the way, the engineers balked at first, but they very quickly, to their credit, the team totally got it. And they're like, they're carrying on in my place now, like, you know, like it's jihad now over there. They totally get it. Anyway, the thing that we found out from the no regressions policy is even if you're not focused on performance and you're just making check-ins on other things, but you never regress performance, dumb luck will make you faster. Entropy will make you faster. You're going to get gains not even trying. So why would you ever regress? I mean, that's like crazy. You know, don't give up ground on good fortune. You know, you're winning the lottery there. You know, it may be 1%, but 1% is 1%. If you could measure it and repeat it, well, ka-ching, you know, that's money in the bank. And you certainly never want to give up gains on hard work. That's just crazy.
Well, so how do you balance that with, you know, let's say there's a certain CSS feature that you need to implement.
Well, that's a story in my talk right there.
Yeah.
That was a great example. So when Dave Hyatt, the brilliant Dave Hyatt, was shortly after he joined the team, we noticed that, he noticed because he's like much smarter than the rest of us. And he was the first person on the team I really allowed to actually spank KHTML, right? Because I had the rest of the engineers focused on making everything around the engine actually work until they got enough domain knowledge to go in and actually change things. But Dave had been working on web engines at Mozilla for a while, so he had the experience. And so he came in, and some of the first things he started on, because he joined the project a year in, was that KHML was really awful at DOM whitespace handling at the time, and this would mean you would get an incorrect DOM being created, and it was causing all sorts of compatibility problems. So Dave worked on this huge patch for over a week, and we really needed this, you know, correctness improvement. And he came and he told me he was working on this, and I thought it was a great idea. And he came to me and said, "Okay, the patch is ready." I said, "Okay, what's the performance impact? How did you test?" We put it on the scope, and it was 8% slower. And I was like, "We really need this feature, Dave, but you can't check it in." And he was like, "But it's doing so much more work, you know, because it was doing a lot more measurement and stuff like that." And it has more features, you know, and I would hear that thing from people over the years, and I was like, "Nope, find a way to make it faster." And he grumbled at first, but he went away for a few days, and he came back with another version of it that was 1% faster than what was in the tree. Really? So he made a 9% improvement and put us on the line. So not only did we get the new feature, but we got a 1% performance improvement. So that's what you do. You never regress, right? When I hear about people that are, well, it's doing all this extra stuff. No. Now, you have to be very, very careful about what your metrics are, what your benchmarks are up front.
I was just going to ask that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to bite yourself in the ass later on.
And well, it's almost like engineers
have learned showing me demos of, you know, little things that they're working on ahead of time, not to show me something that's really performant because it's not using real data or not connecting over the network, not a simulation. Because if they show me the real thing after that and it's slower, then I don't like it.
Right.
You know, don't show me something that's not going to be the real behavior, because that's going to make me angry.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about the metrics. Like, if you're not measuring the right thing, then this kind of religious fervor to meet the metrics is just going to end up being misguided. So I think that's probably the key, is trying to dissect and figure out exactly what you want to measure and what you want to stick to.
And it's really hard, and it took us a while to get the hang of that on Safari and WebKit. It really did. We had too many simplistic metrics in the beginning, and these benchmarks are really hard, especially when you're dealing with live content and making the stuff consistent. You have to deal with static pages, and then you have to simulate live connections in other ways. It's maddening, but there are smart people working on this, much smarter than I am. So.
So there's hope.
Yeah, there's hope. I mean, the thing that I interjected into the process was anal retentiveness and a willingness to be an asshole.
Mm.
Because that's what you have to be if you're going to lead a project. You have to say, "No, we're going to have to do this." And you have to be willing to be unpopular.
Right.
It's tough work, but in the end, the engineer's work is much harder. I mean, they were the ones doing the real heavy lifting. Yeah. I just got to be sit back and be a jerk.
Make sure cash your paycheck. Yeah.
Make sure they have dollars. I mean, obviously, I did more than that, but
of course. Yeah. So you haven't been writing. Last time we chatted, you said you were going to be writing, but you've been typing instead.
Well, two things happened. One was the UL conference, and when I first wrote out my talk, which is supposed to be for 25 minutes talk, and I wrote 4,000 plus word outline, and I just tried to, you know, stand and record myself and do the outline. It was like I hit over 90 minutes, and I went, "Oh God,
wow.
I'll have to stop and cut this." And so I cut. And I was actually cutting until the night before Dublin again. I cut some more stuff out there to try to fit it into 25 minutes. And so I was focused on on that. And I just exhausted myself in terms of writing with that. But the other thing that happened was our family member, our dog, our little girl, Labrador Retriever Penny, passed away. And when I say passed away, what that means is we had to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And life was not very pleasant for a while.
Yeah, that's tough. I've been there myself.
Yeah, and so I just sort of walked off the end of something and just didn't want to do anything for a while. But I had to get my stuff together and do something for Ool and focus on that. And when I got back, unfortunately, I had to deal with the fact that we had a plumbing disaster in our house, water everywhere, and ruined carpeting and walls with holes in them and stuff like that. So it was,
Stinks.
Yeah, it literally did stink. We're having to get carpet pads replaced this week and some other stuff done. So we had to do that. The other thing is I started writing again, but it was not on my website. It was code, stupidly. I don't know why. I just got a hair up my ass and started writing some code.
You going to tell us what it is?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
You don't have to.
No. It's fine. I mean, I'll probably put it on my GitHub project page after a friend or two of mine looks at it and tells me, well, this isn't like embarrassing. It won't ruin your career or your street cred. But just to explain, it's not a big thing. I'm not trying to sell this. It's like it's just a little utility. And I feel embarrassed that it took me a week to write the damn thing. But I haven't been coding, especially this is written in Objective-C. I haven't written in Objective-C in a long time. And people probably think I write, iPhone apps like every other day or something like that. And I just don't do that. I'm too lazy for that. I stopped my development of Objective-C and Cocoa geekiness when John Sullivan joined the Safari project because he was so brilliant at it.
That's the thing about being a manager, right? Is that you stop doing your trade and you start doing a new trade, which is managing people, which is a very different thing.
Yeah. Now there are managers who can code and still code, but yeah. I didn't want to be the kind of manager because there were so many things I had to deal with at first Safari and WebKit and then all the other projects I was managing, and then be the asshole who blunders into the tree stomping around and ruining it for the developers. You know, as a manager, what part of your job is, as I always say, is you stand at the back end of the elephant. And you let it shit on you so it doesn't shit on your team, you know, and you deal with all that stuff. It's graphic, but it gets the point across. And when I would have people in my department who wanted to be managers, who wanted to move into that role, I always gave them the talk at first, you know, to frighten them. I gave them the shit sandwich, as I like to call it, you know, which is... Yeah. Here's the bad news. Here's the good news. Glad you want to be a manager. Here's what it's really like. That's the poop in between the layers of tasty bread. And then, I think you could do it. Be on your way. So, so anyway, enough fecal humor. So in this little project, I just had a piece of software that was annoying me for a trivial reason, and I decided to, you know, sort of do my best at rewriting it.
Cool.
And I'm kind of a encoding geek. You know, I like to encode video and audio and test it out and play with stuff. Before the podcast started today, Renee and I were talking about encoding a little bit, and I was boring him about it.
Not boring me at all.
And you know,
do you like the math side of it?
No, not at all. Okay. I mean, in fact, one of the problems of doing this project was, you know, I forgot when I started writing, I was like, oh shit, they told me there was not going to be any math. No, I like the, I like, at least in this code, I like dealing with the whole system. But in terms of encoding itself, I like getting good video quality and good audio quality with the minimum amount of work and time and size, and figuring out what the trade-offs are there.
Yeah.
And I've gotten very good at that as a hobby over the years. And trust me, folks, this is something that you never want to do. By the way, I would say there's sort of three tiers to consuming video and audio. And what I always advise people when they see what I'm doing, oh, could I do that? And I always say, well, you could, but really what you should do is you should go to iTunes, you know, the iTunes store, or Netflix or Amazon Prime or something, and, you know, stream stuff and not worry about this crap. Or, you know, if you have Blu-rays or DVDs, what you should do is you should, you know, use a tool like Make MKV, rip them and, you know, play them back that way. Mm. Only an idiot like myself re-encodes the Blu-rays and DVDs they have. In fact, as we're having this podcast, I've got a batch script with the Handbrake command line app that's been running for weeks now, actually. So I was away at Ool re-encoding, you know, my close to 300 titles of Blu-rays in the background.
That's
because I want to see what the results of that are.
It's a bit of dedication.
No, it's not dedication. It's idiots. This is insanity. Normal people should not do things like this. So, you know, it takes a lot of disk space and time. But, you know, I'm retired. I'm patient. So anyway, so I do this encoding stuff, and you have to test it. And, like, I'm a command line geek. I mean, I obviously like GUIs and stuff, but there's a few apps I spend most of my time in. You know, there are Terminal, BBEdit, Safari, Mail, you know, things like that. But Terminal I spend a lot of time in. Not to disparage my friend Pavel Sisler, who's in charge of the Finder. I do also. I spend a lot of time in Terminal. And so I test stuff with MPlayer, you know, the MPlayer command line utility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good. And because you can pass all sorts of different options to it and things like that. And it tends to decode H.264 more consistently than actually VLC does or something like that.
Hmm.
And it doesn't have little, you know, it has other problems. But anyway, there's MPlayer on the Mac can actually put up a window and have a show you video and stuff like that. But it does annoying things. It, like, they put up this beautiful video window, and then the bottom corners of the window have turds in them, like white turds. And so when you go full screen, they're like these white turds in the corner. And it's like, guys, how hard is it not to put white turds in the corner of the window?
Weird. It's like what? Just part of the window chrome? Or is it?
It's the way they're rendering the OpenGL layer that they created into the window. They're screwing up the mask or something. I don't know what it is.
Weird.
Okay. Looking at the code, and it's hard to figure out. So I thought at first about just going in and debugging it and running a patch. And I hate running patched versions of things, because then you have to keep, mm-hmm. when there are updates, running the patch and stuff like that. I went, well, there's this project out there called MPlayer OS 10 and MPlayer OS 10 Extended and MPlayer X. You know, and they actually all embed MPlayer. How do they do that? I bet I could do that and write a little wrapper for that. And because I didn't like the way that they operated either. You can't operate them from the command line, and they do other annoying things, even though they're nice pieces of software. So I thought, how the hell hard was that? And that's, you know, hubris and ignorance once again. It twisted my arm, and I'm such a sissy when they gang up on me. And so I just started typing. So I had to sort of relearn COCO and Objective-C and stuff. And so I have this little app. I mean, it's only about 650, 700 lines of code, but it's a command line app which wraps MPlayer and dynamically becomes a COCO app.
Nice.
Which is, you know, fun.
Well, it's a bit of a trick, right? Because you got to...
Yeah, because nibs are for sissies.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Nibs are for sissies. And, I'm doing all sorts of things I really hadn't used before. You know, core animation and OpenGL and local event monitoring for the sense, you know, NS tasks and NS connections, because I've got to run MPlayer in another process and communicate with it. And having to use Grand Central Dispatch and blocks, you know, all the new toys the kids like. Threaded connections and threaded rendering and full screen shenanigans with NSView and stuff like that. I actually asked a question on Twitter the other night because I got stuck not knowing what the hell I was doing. And I got some good help from a friend of mine. So it's fun and, you know, and it works. I mean, it took me a while to like sort of reverse engineer MPlayer, even though I had the source code in front of me, because it's kind of it's huge, it's old, and it's kind of crufty, but it does work. I mean, to their credit, it does work very well. So after I got this, it's almost done. I've got to do a few other things and make the code not look like it sucks, and then I'll put it up on my GitHub page. And I thought, you know, what I really need is a better player app. And so I may have convinced myself to actually write a real Cocoa application that's a media player.
That'd be good.
Yeah, because QuickTime Player's full screen mode annoys the hell out of me, because it uses the Lion, Mountain Lion full screen mode.
Yeah, QuickTime Player.
I just hate that.
Yeah, that used to be an awesome app.
QuickTime 7.
I mean, QuickTime Player basically seems like a wraparound Qt Kit, effectively, which is
fine. It actually is a nice GUI, and I'm glad that they did something that a lot of people don't do with apps, which they just sliced off an enormous number of features. The problem was they sliced off the features and they didn't put them anywhere. So you have to have both apps around, which is just, and you, if you're going to take features out, you need to make sure people have a way to do those things. And that was a problem, but it's a nicely designed app. But I don't like the full screen mode, because I've never liked the Lion, Mountain Lion full screen mode, the slow ass switch and stuff. It's pretty, but I want something instantaneous. And it only really, it doesn't play very many formats. It's really good for MP4s and certain kind of AVIs, but if you have other things, you can't play them with it.
Well, like MKV just does not.
It doesn't work. So you need VLC or one of the MPlayer wrappers for that.
Yeah, and VLC is an ugly. Ugly. I don't like VLC either.
Well, the issue with VLC is it's got the iTunes disease. You know, it's become everything.
Right.
Now, that works for iTunes. I mean, iTunes, especially the new interface on iTunes that people have laid a lot of hate on the iTunes team for, I think is actually great. I think it's
definitely an improvement over the old one.
Yeah, it's a definite improvement, and it's basically, it's simplifying the app without actually simplifying it, which I think is a great thing. And so what I meant with the iTunes disease was a joke we'd make every once in a while. You keep putting features in it. VLC has too many features right now. I mean, I'm a maniac about, you know, before I release any code or release anything, what I always go is, what features can I cut out of it? What don't we need? Like, even before I released my little piddly Magneto, my little site generator, I cut features out of it. Not that it has a lot of features right now, but I thought, why am I doing that? You know,
you just features that you weren't using yourself, or what?
No, they could be done another way and one that I wasn't using myself. So why do I want that in there? And they were pretty minor features, but that as an example. I mean, there are features, for example, in Safari that I've tried for years to cut out. I can't do anything about it now, but look at the preferences in Safari. I think you probably take about half of those preferences out of there. So
yeah, that's a good focus. Yeah.
Well, a really smart man, Darren Adler, taught me something years ago, and he was talking about assessing features, and he said assessing preferences.
Mm-hmm.
Deciding on how to do a preference. And the thing to do when you're arguing back and forth about something, it's like, well, okay, it's a preference, but which is the default? Because you're going to have a preference, you have to have a default setting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you decide on what the default setting is. And then you get rid of the preference because you decided on the default. And you never ship that. That's the whole point. Make decisions. Limitations are clarity. They're features too. And that's really, kind of an Apple approach. Back in the old days at Netscape, we used to joke, how many preferences does Netscape Navigator have? All of them. Boy, you get really lost inside that preferences dialogue back in the old days. Now, Mozilla team's credit, they with Firefox, they've vastly improved that, but it's still pretty complicated.
I think it's not only is it good for the user in that the giant preferences box is confusing, but it's good for the team and the software itself because it's just fewer sort of places for things to go wrong, really. There's like fewer pathways to disaster.
Exactly. Less stuff to test, less things to confuse people. I mean, I know I've been responsible for features that I thought at the time were really good ideas, and they turned out to be, not popular or confuse people about something else that you wanted people to use. I think Apple is one of the best companies out there doing software and hardware for keeping things simple and keeping the focus right. We still didn't do everything great. I mean, that's why I really applaud the iTunes team and the idea of like trying to focus things down. That's very hard to do. It takes courage to do that and possibly annoy people.
Especially with such a high visibility app, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they did a real, really good job walking that line. And, I use it. I find it's fine. It still has way too much stuff in it, but they're doing a much better job of hiding it.
Well, hiding it without it being totally inaccessible.
Yes.
Tucked away, maybe more than hiding. Yeah.
Very, very hard to do.
Yeah, definitely. You're working on an iTunes killer?
No. Not, when I say media player, mostly I'm considering writing something, basically a video player, something that's very simple and straightforward and something that could sit alongside a QuickTime player to be pretty and to play other formats. I mean, InPlayer X has the potential to do that, but it seems to be maintained kind of sporadically, and there are certain design decisions in there that are just like maddening to me.
I would like that because a lot of that kind of stuff just seems kind of janky to me. A lot of it feels like it came from the Linux world and got a Mac paint job.
Right. But, literally it did because it's got the InPlayer, which started out as the Linux, movie player.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, what was his name? I don't know if I can even pronounce his name. Cloaken Peter Priedel? I don't know where he's from. The guy who did the original InPlayer OS X project back in the turn of the previous decade, that's essentially what he was doing, is he was putting a Mac wrapper around Emplayer. Right. Now, you can do that, and you can do it the right way. You can basically hide the fact that that actually exists and make it look like a real Macintosh application. I think, what's his name? Zongyao Q, the guy who does Emplayer X, made a pretty good stab at that, but there are certain behaviors and other things that still don't work really well. And then we have VLC, which is whose interface looks like VLC. It's a good app though, but
yeah.
So,
well, I mean,
so anyway, yeah. I'm thinking about it.
Well, but I'll encourage you to do so.
I'll probably come to my senses.
Please don't stay crazy.
Yeah, I'd kind of like something the worst thing about doing it though is that then I'd have to maintain it. You know, I was winking Zhang Yao about, you know, because he has a real job and he's doing that on the side. I don't have a real job. I'd really have to maintain it. So that's the worst thing about putting stuff out there is maintaining it. Yeah, I don't want to just throw something over the wall.
So, well, I mean, you could. You just toss it out and then have somebody else pick it up and run with it.
Oh yeah, but I've got way too huge an ego.
Yeah.
I put these pretenses on about being a humble guy, but yeah, I'm just as much of an asshole as everybody else out there about that kind of stuff. Now, you know, when I've worked on other open source projects, I've obviously tried not to do that back when I briefly worked on LAME, the MP3 encoder.
Mm.
I tried to play nice with that community and worked pretty well back there. Thankfully, they've rewritten all my code by now, but because I had to stop contributing to it when I went to work for Apple.
I hadn't realized you'd been involved with LAME.
Yeah, I didn't do any of the really hard stuff. I did the easy shit. LAME in the early on, somebody added the ability to do ID3 tag support, ID3 version tag support. And the world had moved on to ID3 version 2, which is a really, in a way, kind of over-engineered, wacky
stuff. It's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. And but it was what everybody was using. And I hated running a tagger after I would encode something, so I started doing a hack, and it just kind of got out of hand.
Mm.
And so I developed it into a set of patches and asked the team if they wanted to use that, and they accepted it in the tree. But Robert eventually rewrote all of my stuff, thank God.
So would you say that that's how a lot of open source contributions happen? Or is it more of it? Because there's two things, right? We were just talking about Google and Apple and they're splitting and forking and they've got full-time employees working on stuff.
Yeah, but that's actually very rare.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, most open source is just random people getting annoyed with something and fixing it, right?
Yeah, it's scratching an itch.
Yeah. Was that true for WebKit at any point? Or is that always more for professional sort of?
Well, I think that's true for some of the people who joined the team from the open source world.
Mm.
They went in because there was something that they wanted to do and it sort of got out of hand and became a career. Yeah, because they were scratching an itch. I've hired plenty of people like that. Just sure. Amazing engineers that way. But the projects that I've contributed to, which are very few, sometimes it started out that way. Or this thing, this program that I wrote this last week, it, you know, it's like, oh, damn it. You know, I want it to work this way, not that way. And I did something really stupid. I wrote a completely separate program rather than develop a patch for what was there, which is which is the height of egomaniacal stupidity. So
I don't know. I'm looking forward to it.
So we'll see. I've got to make sure I don't I don't have any bugs. I ran into a hideous bug last night. There's this protocol in MPlayer that I think was developed by originally one of the OS X contributors for communicating with a GUI app.
Mm.
And I suppose it was a good idea at its day, but it's really hideous. I mean, you know, it sends the host app through an NS connection that you create.
You mentioned that. That seemed odd to me.
Yeah, it sends you the height and width and the aspect ratio. It sends you the aspect ratio as an integer. Which is just completely useless. So the arguments are integers. So it's completely nuts. And it defines some functions that can be called, you know, start, render, and stop, which are supposed to be called in that order. Of course, except when they're not called in that order by MPlayer as it's running in the background. Because I had a crasher last night I discovered when it was calling stop before it ever called start.
And I was like, whoops. I hate that kind of stuff.
That's class communication protocol stuff.
Yeah, that's the worst.
It would do that for every AVI file I would flow through it. And I'd stupidly been testing it the whole week with MP4s and MKVs and stuff like that. And I hadn't run an AVI file with XVID in it. And it was like, here, I'll stop before I start.
It's weird that AVI is different. Is there a command stream in an AVI file or something?
I have no idea. I mean, this is why I'm such an idiot to do something like this, because a lot of the those kinds of internals, you know, I never really pay attention to. I'm more concerned about higher level. I actually enjoy writing all the plumbing. It was just a boatload of fun figuring out how to, you know, to run something as a separate task, and which I'd never really. I mean, I'd sat over code like that before and talked to my engineers before, but I never actually sat there in an editor and wrote all the stuff or put the, you know, the distributed object type connection and stuff like that done it myself. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, I had other code to look at, some of which was very nice examples and some of which was like,
Yeah, distributed objects are cool, but kind of crazy.
Yeah, kind of crazy. And it's a sort of a pseudo distributed object. Basically, what you do is you create an object locally and say it has this protocol, and then you register via a connection this name called back down that. And the crazy thing was, it actually worked the first time I did it. I couldn't believe it. I thought I'd done something wrong. That was actually turned out to be one of the most straightforward parts of it. It was like the renderer. I spent all this meticulous time not even testing the OpenGL code, but just writing it and code reviewing and whatever. And I ran it, and I didn't get anything rendered at first. I went, oh, well,
it's OpenGL. That's
you know, it's too
never
hard.
Never happens. It never works first time. Doesn't do it.
Yeah. But the OpenGL code was perfectly fine. It rendered perfectly. I had passed the wrong parameter to one other function down the line. That was the entire reason why it didn't work.
Yeah, so it's a way. I don't know about you, but I never am more nervous about my code than when I run it and it works perfectly every time. Yeah, I type it and it works. I'm like, whoa, something's screwed up here. There's something really bad is happening.
Yeah, so it was some of the more trivial things that that didn't work that threw me. Like I ran into every noob's screw job with the NS Notification Center. You know, I've got like two threads running in the app, and stupidly try to notify the other thread with the Notification Center, forgetting that doesn't work at all. And I was getting called back on the same thread. And why does it work that way? Well, that's because that's the way it's designed to work that way. That's a feature, not a bug. And I go, oh shit, what's the best way to communicate with another thread? Give a quick iMessage to my old buddy and former engineer, Ricky Adams. And I said, suggestions? And he said, GCD is your friend. I went, oh, yeah. So a little async dispatch call took care of that painful swelling and all was well.
Yeah, pretty sure you got a contact list that can help you with a lot of these kind of problems this year.
It's like crib notes during a test.
Or a lifeline during a game show.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Lifelines, that's what it is. Renee, that is perfect. Perfect analogy. Lifelines. I got a lot of lifelines. And they're all brilliant people, a lot smarter than I am. And I'm sure they could have written everything I've written in like a day. So I've got the world's slowest engineer, so. So they probably wouldn't have wanted to write this. Who the hell would? So we'll see what comes next. But I've got to get back to my website writing and
please do.
What I'm going to do is probably take this 4,000 plus pages of notes that I wrote for that talk and turn some of those into blog posts. I just got so tired of repeating and rehearsing the talk that I don't want to look at the material. I mean, I actually told
you. Just read it into Siri. Have her dictate the post for you.
Jed, question for you. Do you guys actually, how often do you guys use Siri?
A lot.
Wow. I'm impressed.
Seldomly. I use it for setting timers and alarms and shit that it can't fuck up.
Ah. Okay.
I dictate posts while I'm driving with it so I don't forget the hook that I had when I thought about it.
Apple loves people like you, Renee.
I think I said this before, but...
I always think whenever I use it and it just works perfectly and it does what I want, I think to myself, why don't I use this more often?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, then it screws you.
Well, occasionally it'll get confused, but usually that's an amusing interlude. I mean,
One thing I do find cool about Siri is, it's an amusing interlude. even like if I'm telling it to remind me of something and it gets it wrong, at least when the reminder comes up, there's enough like phonetic information sort of there that I know what it's talking about.
Yes.
You know, like maybe it screws up the name and it's like, it says Rave rather than Dave. And it's like, well, okay, fine. I know what it's talking about, you know?
But it's much faster UI to enter reminders and calendar events than anything that's, you know, touch-based.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Doing it with Siri is much easier than typing in on a phone. You know, my friend Ken Kishinda, you know, he's the person probably most responsible for the keyboard interface for the phone. And I still, you know, prefer talking to Siri for doing long things like that rather than typing. So I'm such you know, I'm all thumbs, literally. So I can actually type very fast on my Mac, and compared to some people on the phone or the iPad, I do type very fast. In fact, typing is probably the most useful thing I learned in high school. I swear, it's a thing. Not the math, you know, not even English lit. It's typing, learning to type. But I still, you know, I hit the Cupertinos all the time, and it drives me crazy, the autocomplete. But I never turn it off because it also saves me more times than it
screws me up.
Yeah, because my spelling is atrocious. I mean, if I you know, I what I would write would look like Middle English spell checking.
Yeah, spelling is over. That's what, you know, computers can do that now.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Actually, I think I said this before, but I have a godson who's 4 years old and he can't write, but he uses Siri to send me text messages, which is awesome.
See, that's what it's perfect for. That was like Charles was saying at UL that, you know, people, Charles Perry saying at UL is that, you know, you don't realize it, but there are sight-impaired people out there who can use a phone right now to see. You know, there are apps out there that exist that they can hold up to take a picture with a camera, and it can tell them the colors of what's in their room or their garden.
That's so cool. I'm really fascinated by this kind of stuff. I think there's a... So the way that the accessibility stuff works is that you basically describe the functionality or the – I don't know. How would you describe it, Don? Like you describe – you don't describe the layout. It's not about the visuals or anything. It's about what the content represents.
Right. And you have to realize that iOS like macOS is one of the most advanced operating systems out there for providing accessibility support, because so most of the stuff you just get for free. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
But there are parts like the stuff you're talking about, Guy, that you do.
Yeah, well, I mean,
but I'm not an expert on this, right?
No, no, and neither am I, but it totally fascinates me. And I love the idea that you can describe, you can, if you set everything up correctly in your iOS or Mac app, there can be a totally different interface to your application put on top of it via the accessibility stuff. It just so happens that VoiceOver is the one that works, but the way the content is described and when worked out can work in so many different ways. It blows my mind. Fascinates me.
Yeah. Charles had this video that he played during his talk of Stevie Wonder talking. Mm-hmm. This was before Steve Jobs passed away. I believe it was the spring when it was known he was very sick, and it was from Stevie Wonder, one of his sessions, and he got up in front of the crowd after a set and asked people to pray for Steve Jobs, because he talked about how much he loved his iPhone, and he said, you know,
wow,
here I finally have a device where I can do everything you can do.
Wow.
With it. And it was very powerful and moving. That's why I loved Charles's talk, as it was just intellectually precise, and then it was emotionally moving, which is both the best kind of speaking coming from, you know, being trained as a minister, and the best kind of writing there is that you want to be able to ever do. And when you think about it, it's not just prose. I always want to impress upon people when they create software. You don't need to just make software that makes sense, that's well-designed. You need, if you want your software to be used, you need to make software that delights people, that tugs at them, right? You know, that gives them a reason to use it even when they don't need to use it. That's the best kind of stuff in the world. If you can do something like that, man, that's you know, I've had glimmers of being able to do that over the years, and that's the kind of thing that always gets you back to writing.
Well, I think people feel that they should be playing all the time, that software should be a toy, that it's to be enjoyed.
Yes, and that's the right way to approach it. I mean, that's what you want. You want people to play and get a shitload of useful things done.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that play is in a game itself. I mean, gaming is frivolity.
Well, that's why I've never really found the animations frivolous in OS X.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the
okay, this is some.
Right. Yeah. I just have this quirk of my personality. I just don't like the full screen transition. And I know the guy who wrote it, that he's a friend of mine, but it just always bugs me. They're not frivolous.
Right. So yeah, it could bug you, but it's not frivolous. Like, you know why it's there, right? It's for
right.
Not you. It's just.
Oh, no, it's not for me. In fact, the reason why the full screen animation transitions there is a very good reason. It's to give people context for what's happening.
Exactly.
Because, you know, the way people tried to solve that problem before is what they would do is they would, the first time you went into full screen, they'd put up a dialogue and say, do you realize you're going into full screen now? You know?
Right.
And it's like, what the hell?
Right.
And so... you know, I like instantaneous full screen, but that's because I'm a geek working at a command line. That's what I like. But the reason why it's done that way on OS X, it's brilliant because people go, oh, I can see my other desktop sliding away and I can see this other thing coming in. And there's a lot of work put into that.
Yeah. Right? And it's quite slow. Yeah.
Oh,
sure.
It's a little too slow.
But I think it's the right speed that people see what's happening.
Yes. Yes.
Like, they're thinking during that process, oh, my desktop is going away and here's my new thing coming in. And for me, it's like, just do it. Just get out of my way and just do it. That's fine. But I can understand why it's sort of laborious in that way.
Let me ask you, too. The first time you used OS X, getting to the delight in the animations, I mean, when I was trying to think of what I was going to do at Easel as it was, you know, augering into the desert floor dying, and I borrowed that G3 iMac from Andy Hertzfeld, and I was playing with OS X. The thing that got me going back there, even though I didn't have a lot of apps there. I had like Terminal and TextEdit and something else, you know, and whatever was in that first version of Cheetah. I would go down to the dock and I would like minimize and expand windows. Yeah. And just watch that, you know, that kind of thing happen and drag stuff around. And I thought, man, this is so cool.
I love that. That's, yeah. I at that time I was writing video games, and just the graphic stack on OS X just seemed to me to be the way of the future, to steal a phrase.
Yeah.
Draw everything into a backing store and then blit it to the screen with a Windows server. It just, you know, I could see that.
That's a video game approach. That was the great thing about it, right, Guy?
It felt like that, you know, like put everything in a texture. It wasn't in that earlier version, but, you know, I could see the way it was going to be. Everything is fully buffered. Just draw into the buffer and then throw a bunch of textures around the screen. Awesome.
And by the way, it's very mature doing that kind of stuff now. I was really stunned and delighted when I was writing this little app about all the wonderful stuff in there. Like the first time I created a CG or a core animation texture cache. Mm-hmm. It's like totally easy. And the layer, you know, you just attach a layer to a view. You say the view set wants layer, set layer. And, you know, and it automatically resizes and moves around. Everything is taken care of for you magically.
So good. It's so good.
It's like one of those Japanese toilets that wipes your butt. And it's just so good. That's like Arc.
I don't know if I would have said that.
Yeah, well, that's so me good. Being fecal again. Arc, this is the first time I've actually written something in Arc.
Yeah,
it's like,
how do
oh
you
my
like
God,
that?
I'm never going back. It's like, I retain release. Screw that. This is – now I have to put the – before I do release, I have to put the scope on this and see if I actually am leaking anything and do some other measurements. Because performance is really good, but, you know, you can have really good performance because you're leaking the world. Right. You can use Arc badly, and having multiple threads and stuff like that, you have to be careful with it. But syntactically, and the clarity in the code and everything else you're doing, it's I'll never go back from that. But I still like the original name for Arc that we had.
Yeah, it was Arr.
Yeah, Arr, because we were walking.
Who told me that?
Automatic retain release. Arr. But the marketing guys got a hold of it, and then it became Arc. Damn it. So, but yeah, that's because you can write C, you know, because that's what Objective-C is with this weird syntax from Smalltalk. You can write C like it's Ruby or Python. I mean, Jesus, it's just so easy. You have to take a few precautions, like this stunt, you know, where I have a command line app that becomes a Cocoa application. You know, I have to have my main function. I have to wrap that in an at auto release pool. You know, little thing there, and you have to do that. You have to remember to do that on your thread entry. But
It's nice to
add auto release pool. The great thing about it is, even if you're not using Arc, those directives will do all the other old stupid nonsense for you anyway. So,
there's a bunch of good stuff to command.
They can't.
It still hurts my brain looking at like just calling Alec init on something, and then not releasing it someplace later. Like I still trip over that mentally. But you know, I'm just being an idiot.
It took me about a half an hour, and then there was no looking back.
Yeah. So my main product that I work on is not Arc yet, but I'm working on a bunch of other stuff that is Arc. So I'm slowly getting.
You know what's not Arc yet, but will be hopefully this summer, is Xcode itself.
I'd believe that. Yeah, it's. You know what? Xcode was GC. It was garbage collected.
Right. Because the Xcode, you know, always was the big, let's eat our own dog food kind of thing. You got to respect the Xcode team for that.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It gets a lot of hate that it doesn't deserve, I think.
Yeah. Although I was cursing it this week with, you know, the online documentation thing is fantastic. Xcode is the best environment to work in, even though I'm not using it now. I'll explain why. To work in compared to everything else that's out there. Like if you're developing Android apps now, I mean, Xcode is so much better than what the Android folks have. But the documentation viewer is so damn slow when you type into that little search field. Oh, I just want to strangle somebody. Because the indexing, I don't know what's going on there with indexing, but it just makes me nuts. I can actually go into Safari, type what I want into DuckDuckGo window, what I want, and even saying site colon developer.apple.com and hit return and get results faster than I can sometimes looking up the documentation. At
that is exactly what I do.
Yeah.
But without the DuckDuckGo.
Oh,
I should try that out a bit more. But yeah, well, like the document windows.
It's not built into Safari, but I try to reduce my surface area as much as possible with Google. Well, it's just, you know, it's privacy and other concerns.
So. Yeah, it's not a bad idea.
Don't recommend that.
Go ahead.
I said I don't recommend that for everybody. And I also don't recommend the stunt that I'm doing now to develop my little app because I'm actually not writing it in Xcode. I'm writing it in BBEdit.
Pretty old school.
Well, you know, I'm 56 years old, so there's nothing I do that's not old.
Come on. You're still hip with the kids.
It's that new lingo. God. Sometimes I try to talk like the pseudo-hip person just to annoy my 22-year-old son, especially when his homies come over. They were over the other night.
Don't worry. You swear far more than anybody that age, so don't worry about it.
Exactly.
You're rocking.
So anyway, I like to embarrass him. But getting back to BBEdit and the way I was writing this, it's basically BBEdit in a make file. And it's all like one file because I'm heinous. What I'll do once I'm done is then I'll break it up into separate source files and probably stick it in into Xcode just to make sure everything else runs. And then also so I can do some automated tests. But I'm, you know, it's nothing for me. Just, you know, whip out a text file, do a make file in like 5 seconds and boom, you're good to go, right?
Yeah.
So,
And
I actually, this is crazy, but when you start a project and it's really small, doing it in a single source file is actually very useful because it makes it much easier to search and replace and do everything else and understand the context of what you're at. But once you get to 1,000 lines, well, you're screwed.
Yeah.
You break.
I'd helped fix a project like that. It was like a game from the jailbreak world that we ported to run on the first iOS SDK.
Yeah.
And it was one giant file.
How many lines?
Oh, God. More than 1,000. Like, it got out of hand. But it was just, you know, it was the guy having fun and just hacking on it. And it turned into a product. And, wow, that was a bit of a pain in the ass. But
I'm sure that program was still shorter than the original NetGet URL function in Netscape Navigator 4. Still short.
I bet.
Sorry, never did you.
No. I bet. I was going to say that. Yeah, I can see the sort of the joy of just having one file and just typing in a bunch of stuff and having it work. I mean, that's how I got into programming, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. And it's like writing a script, right?
Yeah, but like basic.
Don't
or anything
do this
like
at home. Don't listen to the old crazy man.
Yeah, do not do this, but I can see the appeal.
And so, and for me, that was useful because I can scroll. You know, it's funny. I can scroll it up and down in my head. I don't know about you, Guy, but after years of programming, when you're not in front of the terminal, you can scroll your code right up in front of your up and down in front of your eyes, make the edits and stuff like that.
Yeah, I can see the structure. Like I just kind of know where stuff is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's creepy. You know, you describe this to other people, and they just think that you're some kind of serial killer, which, you know, it takes the same sort of capabilities to do that.
I don't know. So, I've been watching a lot of Dexter recently, so I don't want to get.
Oh really? Oh really? Yeah. God, I'm like two seasons behind now.
Oh, I just started. I'm like in the middle of the second season. Yeah.
Oh, I got to say the first season of Dexter is one of my favorite.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant.
Episodes of television. Just terrible in a way when you think about it, the morality of, you know, rooting for a serial killer.
It's horrible.
What they do to your head. It's like, I can't.
It's kind of Sopranos morality.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the Sopranos. So, but I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, I'm enjoying it.
Very much so. I've got so much. I don't know why I'm encoding all this stuff because I've got so much stuff queued up that I still haven't watched. I've probably got a year's worth of TV and movies that I still need to watch. And, you know,
it's your affectation, man. It's just, it's what you got to do. What do you do? You encode. That's it.
Yeah. And I you know, I do, because I want to see if I can get the best possible thing at one time. And I was talking to Renee before the broadcast started about, you know, getting stuff from iTunes, and Renee saying, well, it's still not Blu-ray quality.
Yeah, we did that. One of our recordings we did in 4K, and we're playing around with trying to get it online right now.
And that's, I just think it's insane that it 4K. Wow, I'm impressed. 4K.
Well, we'll be impressed if it works. We'll see.
Wait, but anyway, so
at those bit rates, you're never going to get Blu-ray quality.
Right. Yeah.
But you can get something that's reasonable that 99% of people can see on their HDTV sitting across the room at 5 megabits 1080p. And that's what iTunes, most of their 1080p video is. Now, the odd thing is their 720p video, it's 4 megabits. And you go, wait a minute. I'm watching 720p and it's 4 megabits. And the 1080p is only 20%, you know, 20 to 25% larger in terms of number of bits, bit rate. How the hell does that work when the actual viewing area is 2.5 times? And it's the weirdities of our eyes and resolutions and stretching things that actually pulls it off. So,
you know what? I was watching Zero Dark 30 over iTunes, and in that helicopter assault scene, it's awful. It's like blocky. It's like MPEG city. I was distracted to the point of just being angry. It's like,
but I saw the movie, and that whole scene was poorly shot in terms of the darkness. They could have shot it all through infrared and made it much more legible to the viewer.
Oh yeah, okay.
Well, they're not to dive too deep on encoding problems. They're sort of there's a few problems that encoders run into. H.264, comparing it to MPEG-2, that run into, and that's the, you know, the blockiness kind of thing. But there's also the kind of thing where you can get a lot of blockiness where you have very subtle color change.
Yeah, it doesn't capture it, right?
Make yourself sad and watch, you know, a couple of animated films on iTunes, and you'll see some, you know, large, very sort of tapered surfaces, which seem to have some stair step effect. And you know, the way to fix that is simply more bits. I mean, that's the only way you're going to get around that problem. That's why that's the problem that a lot of people make the mistake at. The big thing these days, a lot of people are really hot for are obviously doing things like, I don't know if you're familiar with X2 264. That's the encoder that I'm using built into Handbrake. And they have a mode, CRF, constant rate factor, which you give it a quality setting, and then it goes and does stuff, and you basically get a variable bit rate encode. And this sounds like a wonderful idea, except that to get it, use the same quality setting on every movie, if you're going to take like Blu-rays or DVDs as source bits, you're going to have to set such a high quality setting that on occasion you'll have output that's larger than your input. And so, believe it or not, the way Apple is doing it, by doing essentially a fixed bit rate, is actually a better way to go with getting consistent quality, because really noisy stuff is going to look noisy anyway if it's complex. You know, the original was noisy, the encoded version is noisy. And for things that are very still animations or very quiet movies, you want a lot of bits in that kind of stuff, because your eyes will notice the details. So you can't use a lower quality setting, a lower bit rate. And so what I've developed is a way to do, believe it or not, single pass encodes with X264, they get a lot of the same benefits as CRF. And it's through a very simple little option that you pass to X264. It's called rate tolerance equals infinite. And you get a fixed bit rate single pass encode that behaves like a CRF encode, and it looks a lot like what iTunes is doing. And it occasionally runs into some of the same quality oopses, but not nearly as many. And cool. I can record a Blu-ray on average in real time on my iMac that way.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, right. And if you ever
want to... That is interesting.
Yeah, if you ever want to waste another 2 hours talking about encoding, boy, can I bore you. Because I've done a lot of things, so
it's a date.
Yeah, it's a date.
Perfect.